Shifting baselines.
Welcome to Shifting Baselines, a podcast on sustainability and club culture dedicated to creating awareness, sharing knowledge, and diving into the complex relationship between the planet and raving. In this episode, facilitator, collective care practitioner, music nerd Sarge Lynch finds old cassette tapes in the basement and wonders how they are linked to clouds. Learn why music is more than just sounds and why storing anything in a cloud besides water is actually quite impossible. We hope you feel inspired while listening. Thinking about the impact of human behavior on the planet can be tough. Please be gentle with yourself when engaging with the content we are sharing with you. Take breaks when needed. Play your favorite record or drink some water. If you want to learn more about the project, please visit refugeworldwide.com/artists/shiftingbaselines.
My name is Sarge Lynch, they, them. I'm a community organizer, facilitator, and music nerd who sometimes DJs, sometimes organizes music events, sometimes talks, and yes, sometimes even writes about music. But when it comes to raving, the role that matters most to me is dancer. On this episode of Shifting Baselines, we'll be exploring the relationship between music and materiality. What exactly is the matter of recorded dance music? And how does that matter link to the extraction of planetary resources and human labor? What are the impacts of recorded dance music in terms of our growing climate crisis? What role does dance music have to play in our shared futures? I bought my first vinyl record somewhere around 2003. My mom, a librarian at a public elementary school, let me check out an old suitcase-style record player from her school's technology room. What she called a long-term loan, with a wink that suggested long-term meant nobody was going to come looking for this technology anytime soon. After setting up the record player on my bedroom dresser, I hopped in my car, a gray, beat-up 1990 Acura Integra, with my FM radio probably blasting my favorite indie rock of the moment. I headed down to the local used bookstore, which I remembered also had a vinyl section, and spent a couple hours flipping through the 10 or so bins of used records. Lots of country, lots of Christian, lots of soundtracks, and a decent amount of, well, random shit. After poking around for a bit, I settled on Dare by the Human League, a band whose name I didn't know at the time, but whose classically 80s pop white cover with inset makeuped eyes caught my attention. So I paid, brought it home, and tried to figure out how to work this little machine. Its gray-blue case, with a metal label stamped Property of Fort Worth Independent School District, had a clip at the front which, once unlocked, revealed its plastic apparatus. When the dark blue tone arm was lifted, the little plastic plate that holds the record would automatically start spinning at either 78, 45, or 33 rotations a minute, or RPM, depending on where the speed switch, a fairly rudimentary pitch shifter, was positioned. I think I played the first three tracks at the wrong speed to start, realizing after a minute that the vocals weren't supposed to sound this much like the Chipmunks. So I pitched it down from 78 to 45, and then 45 to 33. Over the next 21 years, I would spend thousands of dollars and euros of my hard-earned cash on this very expensive analog habit, picking up records, both used and new, whenever I traveled to a new city or on my days off in my homes of Fort Worth, Boston, and eventually Berlin. Berlin, I would eventually find, is a wonderland for vinyl lovers. Like many, I was drawn to the city in part by its baseline-studded dance floors, evanescent spaces of play and discovery that kept me and many others like me coming back for more. Weekend after weekend, month after month, year after year. Beyond the dance floor, Berlin was, and still is, a treasure trove for analog music collectors like me. After we left the rave, my music nerd friends and I would usually double back to one of our flats, where turntables and shelves of carefully filed records often waited for us. For hours, we'd dig through our friends' collections or show off our own, beaming with pride when someone asked for a track ID, taking this invitation to tell the record's story, where we found it, when we played it, who played it the first time we heard it. Tapestries of music memory unfolded. These rituals of music exchange are some of my fondest memories of my early 20s in Berlin. Long nights when music, especially dance music, became the glue that bonded me to so many special people, some of them friends I'm still lucky enough to hold dear to me now in my late 30s. Compared to other genres of music, the history of dance music is tied up with vinyl. After all, DJ stands for disc jockey, the person who originally moved between discs of music by blending them together using an audio mixer. While record-digging culture is surely a major part of the fandom of many genres of music, part of what's implicit in dance music is the element of DJs surprising and delighting the crowd with their selection and their blends. Whether that means trotting out new or unreleased music, or dazzling the dancers with hidden gems from dusty bins of years past. So, what exactly is the environmental impact of a vinyl record? Well, as with most consumer products, to find out, we have to follow the money. And if you follow it, you've got to go pretty far from Berlin, Thailand to be exact. At least that's what I learned from researcher Kyle Devine. In his book, Decomposed, The Political Ecology of Music, Devine makes the case that music, often revered as the, quote, most immaterial of the arts, has actually always been a significant exploiter of both natural and human resources, and that its reliance on these resources is more problematic today than ever before. The book, a recommended read for anyone who loves music and wants to collect music in a more mindful way, follows the history of recorded music from shellac records to the plastics of vinyl, cassette tapes, and eventually CDs, through to the digital streaming of today. Divine outlines the full supply chain of each of these mediums, highlighting the human and resource costs from the moment of material extraction through how the media are produced, stored, transported, and eventually sold to the end listener. It's a heady piece that sheds light on parts of the so-called music industry, more specifically, the recorded music industry, that most of us listeners usually don't have to think about. Here's a quote from the book in which Divine explains the people behind the material processes detailed in his research. Although shellac records would neither exist nor matter without musicians and listeners, such records would equally not exist without the women and children that harvested and processed insect resin in colonial India. Nor would they exist without the women and men that worked to quarry rocks in Indiana in order to provide a foundation for these recordings, nor without the scientists that pulled all-nighters as they raced to develop the most suitable formulas for these discs. Plastic formats could not exist without the drillers and tool pushers that pumped oil from the ground, or the chemical engineers and material scientists that cracked hydrocarbons and developed polymer compounds to the specifications demanded by the recording industry and its customers. Nor would they exist without the women and men that pressed these records in factories. Vinyl records are made up of a plastic polymer called PVC, polyvinyl chloride, also known as the poison plastic. It's made from a combo of ethylene, found in crude oil, and chlorine, found in salt. The production of this fossil fuel-based material causes chlorine-based chemicals and dioxins to build up in the air, water, and food chains nearby the production plants. These toxins have been proven to cause widespread and severe human health issues: infertility, immune system damage, hormone disruption, impaired childhood development, and even cancer, which most often impact low-income communities and communities of color near the factories. In fact, in 1934, George Orwell penned a poem detailing the impacts of the industrialization of recorded music on a local community. Here's an excerpt from his poem, "On a Ruined Farm Near His Master's Voice Gramophone Factory." As I stand at the lichened gate, with warring worlds on either hand, to left the black and budless trees, the empty sties, the barns that stand, like tumbling skeletons, and to right the factory towers, white and clear, like distant glittering cities seen from a ship's rail. As I stand here, I feel with a sharper pang my mortal sickness, how I give my heart to weak and stuffless ghosts, and with the living cannot live. The acid smoke has scoured the fields and browned the few and wind-worn flowers, but there, where steel and concrete soar in dizzy geometric towers, there, where the tapering cranes sweep round and great wheels turn and trains roar by like strong, low-headed brutes of steel, there is my world, my home. Yet why so alien still? For I can neither dwell in that world nor turn again to scythe and spade, but only loiter among the trees the smoke has slain. Thing is, this poem is only talking about one community that was impacted by the production, where the pressing plant is. But this doesn't account for the sites of extraction of the crude oil, perhaps in the Middle East, the shipment to a place like Thailand, where the oil is processed and turned into PVC resin, the resin combined with more additives in another factory to make PVC compound, then shipped across the world to a production plant in an imperialist country like the United States. Then the records are shipped via trains, ships, and automobiles to record distributors around the world. As with most types of extraction, to not think about the environmental costs of something like vinyl production is possible due to privilege, especially class privilege. It's no wonder that the so-called vinyl revival can be credited mainly to wealthy listeners who have 20 bucks or more to dish out on a new record, complete with custom printed sleeves, special inserts, and, yep, a code to download the digital files to their devices of choice, too. Even as I've slowed my vinyl buying through the years, I still have a soft spot for analog media. Sometime in the autumn of last year, I stumbled down into the courtyard of my apartment to take some trash out in the middle of the night and saw that the front hallway, where the house's donation box, also known as the Feschenks box, usually filled with discarded cardigans, was this time host to, what was that?
A bucket of cassette tapes.
I deposited my garbage in the proper bins and clicked on the overhead light to get a better look. Most of the tapes had handwritten covers with titles like The Dubby Funky Trip Hop Mix and Jungle Slash Drum and Bass Part 1. I poked through with excitement, despite the fact that I'd thrown out my tape deck already 4 years ago. For me, a music collector, this felt like a jackpot moment. But had I left my garbage to take down until the morning, these tapes would have been hauled off by Berlin's sanitation services, along with all the other junk in the hallway that morning. And it got me thinking, as I had many times before, just how many old MP3 players, hard drives, CDs, cassette tapes, 8-tracks, mini discs, and vinyl records had stacked up in landfills over the years. How many boxes of old tapes just like these were gathering dust in basements across Germany or in forgotten bins around the world? So this had me wondering, had the music industry's move away from plastic-based media towards cloud-based music collections and streaming actually been good for the environment? And if so, how good? Did services like Spotify and SoundCloud offer a viable, sustainable alternative to the toxic plastics of the past? Once I started digging into the research, I realized with trepidation that my ideas about the immateriality of cloud-based music were, well, just wrong. In addition to the couple hundred vinyl records I still have in my apartment, the tapes I found recently, and the 3 CD books I still keep close at hand, I've also held onto a box that contains a half dozen hard drives of various sizes, holding my digital music collection, which by now probably amounts to something like 1.5 terabytes, about 6 times the amount of memory on your average smartphone. I like to call myself not a hoarder, but, you know, an archivist. So, because of that, I was a bit slow on the uptake when it came to using music streaming services like Spotify. I think it was the playlist that got me, eventually, realizing that my friends who use these services could create shareable playlists that anyone with the service could listen to, even as I knew that Spotify and most other streaming services weren't paying artists fairly for the streams, my music-sharing interests got the best of me, and I even went so far as to subscribe. Oof. Like most people, when I think of music in the so-called cloud, I never think too hard about the impacts of that. It wasn't until sometime in lockdown, sitting on the banks of Langer See in Berlin, co-processing climate catastrophe with a dear friend, that it hit me. My friend raised the topic of streaming as an environmental cost, questioning just what was the carbon footprint of binging a Netflix series or uploading hours of festival DJ sets to YouTube. That conversation about streaming was a eureka moment for me. I felt like I was Newton who just got hit on the head with the apple. I'd never thought of the environmental impacts of data in that way. While I had come to better understand the greenhouse gas emissions of, say, flying and other modes of transport, My little capitalism-washed brain had never extrapolated the cause and effect maths to suppose the impacts of something like streaming music. What I would go on to learn from there would rewire my feelings about music in the cloud. As of 2023, the music streaming industry was generating more than $17 billion in revenue a year, and is expected to gross over $36 million by 2026, accounting for about 65% of total music revenue worldwide and 84% of music revenue in the US. When it comes to comparing the carbon impact of various media, researchers at Keele University calculated that listening to an album on a streaming platform for just 5 hours is equivalent to the emissions generated by producing one CD. It would take 17 hours of streaming to equal carbon emissions for producing one vinyl record. The production of a vinyl record is estimated to emit about 2 kilos of CO2 emissions per unit. That's about the equivalent of driving 5 miles in a car. CDs, by comparison, come in at about 165 grams of CO2 per unit. Then you also have to account for the energy needed to power the record players and speakers throughout the life cycle of that medium. Streaming, on the other hand, with its limitless libraries and continuous algorithm-driven playtime, gives us the illusion of immaterial music stored in a cloud floating above our heads. But that cloud requires stacks upon stacks of digital infrastructure, not to mention the wires that pipe the data across the world and back and then into our headphones. So is cloud-based consumption really better for the planet? Due to our increased consumption habits, the research shows that the impacts are actually greater than in years past. This word, cloud, is really where the games begin.
I'm always in awe with, you know, how the marketing departments of IT companies managed to pull this idea of the cloud and made us think very effectively that the cloud, the digital, is very much immaterial and the bits are accumulated somewhere floating over us.
That's Marina Otero, an architect who studies, amongst other things, data architectures and how and whether we'll manage to keep up with the data storage demands our consumption habits are creating.
But the reality is much more banal, but also dramatic in certain ways, because the cloud is a system made of servers where this information is managed and stored and circulated. These servers are in data centers that are constructed to be able to provide security for that data, both in terms of physical security, but also they're functioning 24/7. And these data centers are extremely extractive. They use vast amounts of water and energy. They emit CO2, heat. So then apart, you have all these energy infrastructures, materials that have to build all the systems. So at the end, the cloud is not floating over our heads. It's actually very much constructed in the depths of our planet based on extraction of what the planet holds.
Going back to the book I mentioned earlier, Decomposed, in his writing, Kyle Devine also highlights the human aspect of the extraction processes required by music data. He writes, "Data files could not be stored or transferred without the software engineers that develop algorithms or the IT workers who build and maintain internet infrastructures. Such files could not be accessed without miners in places such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, who extract the rare minerals and metals that make up our listening devices. Nor could those files be heard without the soldiers and line workers who assemble these accessory electronics in places such as China. Such workers are not typically thought of as musicians. Indeed, they're usually not thought of at all. At best, they might be considered support personnel. Yet their labors are essential parts of the music world." In addition to the ways we consume music, The ways that music is marketed and how we find out about music also has an environmental impact. Obviously, a huge amount of music marketing takes place on platforms like Instagram and TikTok, which, in their photo and video heavy continuous feeds, account for a major portion of our data diets. For example, just 1 minute scrolling through your Instagram feed is the equivalent of driving 13 meters in a light vehicle. With the average user spending 33 minutes a day on Instagram, that amounts to something like the CO2 equivalent of driving 3 kilometers in a gas-powered car every week. This may not sound like much, but when you think about the fact this happens mainly passively, with little movement from your thumb and often very little agency from the user whatsoever, without any distance traveled, well, we can start to picture how our online footprint gives our mobility carbon costs a run for their money. Since we are researching about the environmental impacts of recorded sound, I couldn't help but wonder, what does data storage actually sound like? In March of 2024, I visited one of Berlin's few inner-city data centers, a small nonprofit provider called In Berlin, together with Julia, the sound designer for this series. We met outside of a complex of dark red brick, somewhere in the industrial area past the Südkreuz IKEA. We were greeted by two of the members of the In Berlin Verein, or association, who agreed to show us around the center. I locked up my bike, and we entered through the back door of the courtyard. As we walked through the first of 3 locked doors, we could already hear the din of servers in the coming room. As we passed through each door and into the server room, the din rose to a roar. Inside the room, about 20 by 30 meters, we saw a few dozen rows of servers stacked on either side of a central aisle, cooled by about 7 different types of fans, including some blasting from the floor when we first came in. Wires of various colors braided their way up from the humming and flashing server stacks into streams suspended above us on the ceiling. A few shelves of car-type batteries, maybe about 30 or 40 of them, were plugged into an apparatus in the corner, hooked up to a lot of dials and monitors. I won't lie that my little nerd self was pretty enamored with both the sounds and the imagery of the moment. But as I rode my bike home, it really had me thinking, if this is just a little guy data center servicing a few dozen local projects, then how many times would you have to multiply this room to host, say, all the videos of DJ sets that live on YouTube? So, what is the impact of the data associated with dance music as a whole? One of the major challenges of climate research is trying to quantify these kinds of questions. A report from 2019 said that in 2016, although there was, quote, only 8,000 tons of plastic waste associated with music, since most of it had moved online by that point, the CO2 emissions more than doubled compared to 2000, when CDs reigned supreme as a format. I had a look into a few of the big dance music channels to try to get an idea of the breadth of data in each one. Boiler Room, for example, a video streaming platform for dance music that started in 2010, claims an archive of 8,000 videos of more than 5,000 artists. NTS, the beloved London-based online radio station founded in April 2011, today hosts two live streams, simultaneous, with music from more than 800 resident artists. According to reports from 2023, the station boasts more than 3 million online unique monthly listeners. Our hometown radio heroes, Refuge Worldwide, founded in 2021, and where I also host a monthly radio show, got back to us and let us know a bit about their archives. Here's Richard, one of the station's co-founders.
My name is Richard Akinbayan. I'm one of the two co-founders of Refuge Worldwide. It's been running as a radio station for 3 and a bit years now. I believe we have done around 6,000 radio shows, so that's probably about 7,000 or 8,000 hours of radio. I think the challenges of sharing so much content are not necessarily logistical ones. The space to host all these shows is pretty affordable. But I would say the challenge is to get people to dig back through the archives as much as they value new content. We need to work on different ways to repackage and share old stuff, because there's a whole archive of amazing stuff there that can be easily forgotten.
How does all this map to greenhouse gas emissions exactly?
As we learned in episode 1 of this podcast, calculations of emissions are difficult for a number of reasons. At an individual level, the carbon footprint of viewing, say, 1 hour of video on demand streaming is approximately 55 grams of CO2 emissions, here in Europe at least. That's relatively small compared to other everyday activities like cooking. The viewing device is typically responsible for the largest part of the overall carbon footprint. So, for example, watching something on a big screen digital TV has a higher impact than watching on your phone. Still, that means if someone watched 4 hours of boiler room videos every day for a whole year, that would be about the same carbon footprint as driving 300 miles in a car or being in a commercial flight for just 1 hour. That's using the calculations from digitalcarbonfootprint.eu.
To be sure, compared to a lot of other ways we produce greenhouse gases, streaming dance music and video is a relatively small slice compared to other things like mobility and food supply, for example. But I think before producing this podcast, I just had very little idea that these activities had any impact at all. I asked Marina what she thought about the current production of data and how that compared to the amount of storage we have and will need in the world, and what technologies she knew about that could help us navigate the difficulties of having so much data to store and process when it came at such a huge cost to the people and the planet.
We are producing more data than one we will be able to store. And if you think about, AI, but also astronomical observatories, scientific research, and our daily life experiences are creating huge amount of data that is very difficult to keep on storing at the pace we are doing. And I've seen also graphs showing the amount of energy and water that is required for these processes, and it's completely impossible to meet that demand. So we will have to take decisions about what we think is a priority, because many territories we have to decide if we power data centers or we power houses.
For reference, today there are about 3 million data centers around the globe, with over 500 cables crossing the world to connect these data centers, mainly under the water, because it's cheaper to install and maintain. This amounts to nearly 1.2 million kilometers of cables in the oceans, which is a length that could circle the Earth 30 times if wrapped around its widest point. In his book, The Dark Cloud, researcher Guillaume Pirot makes these comparisons. If digital technology were a country, it would be the third highest consumer of electricity behind China and the United States. Every year, streaming technology generates as much greenhouse gas as Spain, close to 1% of global emissions. One Google search uses as much electricity as a light bulb left on for up to 2 minutes. I asked Marina, what did she think about, say, so-called innovations like green streaming? I had read that some of the big record companies and even Spotify were committing to what Google was calling zero emissions data storage. Is that maybe a possible solution?
Well, there is nothing very green these days unless we consume less of everything. So even if we think about the so-called green industries, green transition, that means mining, that means getting materials like lithium. They are thinking about building electric vehicles. That implies also energy and extraction. The problem when we criticize, for instance, lithium mining or solar and wind energy that are also disrupting many ecosystems around the world is that we are somehow aligning ourselves with the discourses of the extreme right or pro-fossil fuels. And I think we have to make a distinction. If I'm against lithium, it's not that I'm in favor of, you know, fossil fuel industry. But the question is that we always try to find a fix, you know, to say, oh, we will be able to continue as before. And what we don't want to accept is that we have to change the way in which we live. And until we agree on that and we are able to process that thought and actually implement it, then everything is greenwashing, basically, because everything at the scale we are producing and consuming right now is not appropriate for the planet and is not going to be able to be sustained in any way. Most of the people just think there will be a new technology. Okay, now you are criticizing data centers, but there will be quantum computing will be coming and they will be solved and there will be this other material. But if you look at the graphs, we have been consuming more and more energy in the last, you know, 200 years, regardless of the source of energy, if it's coal or oil or, you know, electricity coming from renewable sources. So I think that there is a compulsive desire for more. That is what I think is at the core of our very unsustainable, pernicious lifestyles.
All of that said, she did acknowledge that there are some interesting developments in greening up existing data structures, processes, and functions. For example, there are investments happening in so-called green infrastructures that includes innovations that go down to the level of algorithms used to process data. There are also always decisions to be made on the level of things like the resolution of audio and video, the speed that data is transferred, and even small design choices like fonts. Every little bit of data adds up over time, and tools like GreenSpectre can be used to assess and improve the efficiency of digital apps. Another interesting area of exploration is how the heat of data centers can be used for good. For example, reusing the heat from servers to grow food or heat homes.
So there are many different practices that mitigate a little bit. This is not enough. But doesn't mean that we have to underestimate also these efforts. I think every effort is relevant. But as you say, we don't have to obscure the real cause of our current problems. But every smaller action, I will say, go for it. I think I'm very much in favor of that.
Thankfully, her research has led her to work with a range of interconnected movements that are fighting back against what she views as a sort of data colonialism. An extraction tendency in which companies, which are mainly based in the global north, end up extracting resources and polluting ecosystems in the global south.
What is beautiful about these movements is that they are very much connected to each other, despite the fact that the contexts are different. Certain strategies of resistance could be shared. So, for instance, lithium mining is water mining. You know, when they open a mine, they are very much mining water. So it's not only the mineral or the elements, but they are using a huge amount of water that are not only affecting the entire ecosystem, but also they probably will end up polluting the bodies of water that are also existing around. That is very important to understand the type of lives that are affected, how to prove actually the pollution that is involved, the environmental cost, because most of the times the companies have quite good teams making environmental reports that are mostly false. But these communities, they lack the resources needed to produce also evidence. So I think there is a lot of solidarity between these movements across the world to try to help each other to see how to produce the evidence that is required to actually stop some of these developments or make the case for not allowing these developments to happen. Still, most of the cases we are talking about very strategic so-called resources. And despite the fact that some environmental reports come out negative, the governments still push for the opening of these mines. That's the case, for instance, in Portugal. Actually, green means to open lithium mines in places like Portugal and Spain and Serbia and other places that you could call also the global south of Europe.
Because of all of this research, Otero has become, in recent years, an advocate of not only consuming less, on the one hand, but also of learning what we need to let go. Due to this, quote, zone of potential insufficiency she described earlier, we simply can't keep up with the amount of data that we're currently producing. She advocates for erasure and even the mourning of data that we are ready to let go of.
Because the cloud is not, you know, this ephemeral, like ethereal entity. When we accumulate information, that is occupying in a space and it's occupying energy, it's using water and so on. So we have to be more aware that our tendency toward accumulating a lot of information, that has implications. Unfortunately, most of us, we are not aware of that when we just take 1,000 images of the same thing, because we can, because we don't have to develop them, we don't have to print them, then we think that they are for free. But no, they have a cost, but that cost is treated as an externality that we might not see, but it happens somewhere. So I'm interested, for instance, in the possibility of, first of all, consuming less, so being more aware, having digital literacy and understanding what it takes to accumulate information. Second, to understand that perhaps we have to learn to erase on information, to actually let things go.
Let things go.
As someone who's always loved to save memories, media, and matter of all kinds, I have to admit that I find this aspect of letting go a difficult one. It's something I'll have to continue to work on. My conversations with Marina have really woken me up to the possibility not only of abstinence, whether that means foregoing taking certain photos with my phone or skipping scrolling through the newsfeed or binging on Netflix series. These habits affect not only my use and abuse of data, my overall carbon footprint as a result, but of course also have effects on both my mental and physical health. At the same time, I've started to think more critically about and integrate practices around deletion and letting go, using my own spirituality rituals, for example, moments like eclipses, to take a moment out of my rushed life to decide, well, what needs to be released, both emotionally and materially. I'm starting to understand how deletion can be a form of both self and communal care. That said, when it comes to erasing or deleting data, Marina was quick to remind us it's easier said than done.
When I've been in conversation with people from these big corporations such as Google, and I proposed the idea of deleting and say, like, why when we receive an email, this doesn't disappear perhaps in 5 days unless we say otherwise? Why by default we are keeping, instead of saying by default this thing will disappear, and we have seen it in different social media, social networks, so why not? And then, but if we want to keep it, we just click. But no, it's built the other way around, because we pay for data storage and because they make money by the accumulation. So actually they were laughing at me, like, oh dear, you're so naive. Actually, we're interested in compressing. So for me, deleting is something like a political act, because what companies want is to keep and compress to make sure that we can accumulate more.
She acknowledges that the act of deleting or erasing also has heavy political and historical implications, especially when we look at the importance of archive for groups who have been historically marginalized. We have seen this happening in Gaza, for example, with the bombing of buildings that housed Palestinian public records, as well as seen many times against indigenous communities and populations on all of our continents. And we've even seen this happening in Nazi Germany as well. The destruction of cultural and historical records is one way that authoritarian regimes attempt to subjugate and overpower groups that they marginalize.
At the same time, you know, when I'm thinking about deletion, the erasing information, we enter in how that is in tension with data sovereignty. So for many communities, the memory and their data is extremely important. So I think each context is very different. When I was proposing for erasing and mourning data, deleting and making this ritual to let things go. When I say that in certain contexts, for instance, in Latin America, in Argentina, in Chile, even in Spain, sometimes it gets very violent reactions, because for many people, to let things go, like memory go, means to align with right-wing discourses that want to erase the past and the, you know, the histories that are connected to violent repression from dictatorships and fascism, etc. So I think this is a very complicated area, and it requires a lot of nuanced positions depending on the context where we are. But in general, I'm interested in this relation between data sovereignty, the right for memory, but also the right to delete information, and how they operate at the level of infrastructure and socio-political practices. But in terms of data centers, it's possible to imagine that instead of huge infrastructures, like the way in which data centers have been designed in the past, these data centers are decentralized infrastructures that could be located in the city's fabric, were it in domestic spaces or community centers, etc. And the way in which data is managed is collective maintenance. And so we have a responsibility towards this common knowledge. We care for it. We are, you know, this collectively deciding what to keep, what not to keep.
So the question of who decides what will be erased and archived, what will be made into history somehow, is also very tied up with power and authority. And unfortunately, at the moment, when it comes to data deletion, most of the power of deletion currently rests not in the hands of the user, but rather in the hands of the corporations that hold the data in their storage centers. That said, in theory, we can still take responsibility for what we consume. As with our travel, eating, or other so-called consumption choices, I was wondering what Marina thought. Is it up to us as music listeners or producers or recorders to make a difference through changing our data habits?
Yeah, we always tend to say the more progressive circles, like, oh, we cannot put the blame on the individual because are the corporations, the governments, or the 1%, which is true. But as we are treated as consumers and we behave as consumers, we also have something to say. And when we care about what we do, we care about, you know, what society at large does. So for me, what is important is that is a combination. The forms in which we have to intervene is a combination of things. For instance, I try to apply it to myself. In the terms of data, it's very simple. I don't have social media mostly, and I try to work also with lower resolutions. I try to see the aesthetic and political value of slower internet and lower resolutions. At the same time, I work with community organizing and supporting certain populations that in their struggle against, for instance, the data center industry. That's something that these communities requested in the case of Chile. Policy changes that give them some protection as well. The big change is only possible in different levels. One is definitely creating some framework of operation. The other, I think that's impossible if there is not position and there is no pressure for that change to happen. And that pressure comes from your realization also on your own lifestyle.
So how does all this talk of collective memory tie back to the story of the dance floor? How does it tie back to our rituals of music creation, recording, and sharing of music as a way to build communities and sustain our shared cultures? And did the party even happen if I can't upload my DJ set to SoundCloud afterwards?
Well, there are particular spaces that I find fascinating and extremely important for the future, like as laboratories, prototypes, spaces where to test new ways of being, new forms of relations, new identities. The dance floor is one. I think the question of embodied knowledge and using your body to communicate with others in a space in different ways is extremely important. And then the question of about identity construction, testing different ways of relating to each other that come out of those situations are extremely important. I would say that I'm interested in the celebration because activism has to go hands in hands with forms of celebration because it's hard. So, for instance, when we were protesting in this lithium mining in the north of Portugal, we always tried to go to the river and swim together and celebrate also these waters that come from the mountain and that might be polluted in a few years if the mine goes away. But this moment of sharing that embodied understanding of our relation with the planet is interesting, is important for everything else that we do. And similarly, I think the dance floor is those architectures that have the capacity to generate new relations and new forms of engagement and living together and new forms of knowledge creation that are necessarily not based on the Western idea of rationality, that they are connected to other type of sensing, relating, and learning differently. So I'm very much in favor of those spaces of relation, and the dance floor is one of the most interesting.
I was happy that Marina and I could connect about this idea of using the dance floor as one of those spaces that was at once both ephemeral, passing by like the wind, and at the same time gave us embodied ways of creating collective memory, beyond the rigid ways of knowing defined by the extractionist, capitalist, imperialist, and racist systems that we live within. I'm a firm believer in the ways that we can cultivate the dance floor as a political space to both celebrate our shared past while also calling in our shared futures. as with my ongoing learnings about the impacts of my mobility choices, my diet, and other aspects of personal consumption, what I learned through this research will definitely give me pause in how I engage with recorded music in the future, especially where my money goes in that regard. Now, when I plan my radio shows or record DJ mixes, I'm going to try to think critically about which ones actually need to be archived, and do my best to open conversations with my fellow residents and other DJs about the same. These learnings will also shape the way I will go into dance floors, festivals, and all kinds of art events in the future. Even more than before, I want to enter these spaces with a dutiful commitment to presence. What might it mean for this particular dance floor experience to exist only this once, here and now, and this place with these particular people, and the context of all of that? What are my ways of relating to this moment if I'm not recording it in any sense? And how might we, together, create embodied memories that we pass to future generations through our very genomes and through our spirits, rather than in the form of data records that can and will eventually decay?
Thank you for listening to Shifting Baselines. Curation and narration of this episode, Sarge Lynch. Idea, concept, and creative production, Kerstin Meisner, as part of her research fellowship at the Research Institute for Sustainability, Helmholtz Center, Potsdam. Sound design and composition, Yuria Flaskina. Editing, Sarah Farina. Artwork, Upashona Ghosh. Accessibility support, Saverio Cantoni. Mixing and mastering, Yuria Flaskina. Support and financial administration, Research Institute for Sustainability, Helmholtz Center Potsdam, especially Achim Maas. Broadcasting and publication, Refuge Worldwide.
Shifting baselines. Shifting baselines.